Chapter 4. It was still not dark enough for Quentin to start, not yet dark enough to suit Miss Coldfield, at least, even discounting the 12 miles out there and the 12 miles back. Quentin knew that. He could almost see her, waiting in one of the dark, airless rooms in the little grim house's impregnable solitude. She would have no light burning because she would be out of the house soon, and probably some mental descendant or kinsman of him or her who had told her once that light and moving air carried heat had also told her that the cost of electricity was not in the actual time the light burned, but in the retroactive overcoming of primary inertia when the switch was snapped. That was what showed on the meter. She would be wearing already the black bonnet with jet sequins, he knew that, and a shawl, sitting there in the augmenting and defunctive twilight. She would have even now in her hand or on her lap the reticule with all the keys, entrance closet, and cupboard that the house possessed, which she was about to desert for perhaps 6 hours, and a parasol, an umbrella, too, he thought, thinking how she would be impervious to weather and season, since although he had not spoken 100 words to her in his life before this afternoon, he did know that she had never before tonight quitted that house after sundown, save on Sundays and Wednesdays for prayer meeting, in the entire 43 years, probably. Yes, she would have the umbrella. She would emerge with it when he called for her, and carry it invincibly into the spent suspiration of an evening without even dew, where even now the only alteration toward darkness was in the soft and fuller random of the fireflies. A fuller and more profound random in the twilight following 60 days without rain and 42 without even dew. Below the gallery, where he rose from his chair as Mr. Compson, carrying the letter, emerged from the house, snapping on the porch light as he passed. "You will probably have to go inside to read it," Mr. Compson said. "Maybe I can read it here all right," Quentin said. "Perhaps you are right," Mr. Compson said. "Maybe even the light of day, let alone this." He indicated the single globe stained and bug-fouled from the long summer and which even when clean gave off but little light, which man had to invent to his need, since, relieved of the onus of sweatin' to live, he is apparently revertin' or evolvin' back into a nocturnal animal, would be too much for it, for them. Yes, for them. Of that day and time, of a dead time, people too as we are, and victims too as we are, but victims of a different circumstance, simpler, and therefore, integer for integer, larger, more heroic, and the figures therefore more heroic too, not dwarfed and involved, but distinct, uncomplex, who had the gift of loving once or dying once, instead of being diffused and scattered creatures drawn blindly limb from limb from a grab bag and assembled. Author and victim too of 1,000 homicides and 1,000 copulations and divorcements. Perhaps you are right. Perhaps any more light than this would be too much for it. But he did not give Quentin the letter at once. He sat again, Quentin sitting again too, and took up the cigar from the veranda rail, the coal glowing again, the wisteria-colored smoke drifting again unwinded across Quentin's face, as Mr. Compson raised his feet once more to the railing, the letter in his hand, and the hand looking almost as dark as a negro's against his linen leg. Because Henry loved Barn, he repudiated blood birthright and material security for his sake, for the sake of this man who was at least an intending bigamist, even if not an out-and-out blackguard, and on whose dead body 4 years later Judith was to find the photograph of the other woman and the child. So much so that he, Henry, could give his father the lie about a statement which he must have realized that his father could not and would not have made without foundation and proof. Yet he did it, Henry himself striking the blow with his own hand, even though he must have known that what his father told him about the woman and the child was true. He must have said to himself, must have said when he closed the library door for the last time behind himself that Christmas Eve, and must have repeated while he and Bon rode side by side through the iron dark of that Christmas morning, away from the house where he had been born, and which he would see but one time more, and that with the fresh blood of the man who now rode beside him on his hands. "I will believe, I will, I will, even if it is so, even if what my father told me is true, and which, in spite of myself, I cannot keep from knowing is true, I will still believe. Because what else could he have hoped to find in New Orleans if not the truth, if not what his father had told him, what he had denied and refused to accept, even though, despite himself, he must have already believed? But who knows why a man, though suffering, clings above all the other well members to the arm or leg which he knows must come off? Because he loved Bonn. I can imagine him and Sutphen in the library that Christmas Eve, the father and the brother, percussion and repercussion like a thunderclap and its echo, and as close. The statement and the given of the lie, the decision instantaneous and irrevocable between father and friend, between, so Henry must have believed, that where honor and love lay and this where blood and profit ran, even though at the instant of given the lie he knew that it was the truth. That was why the 4 years, the probation. He must have known that it would be vain even then on that Christmas Eve not to speak of what he learned, saw with his own eyes in New Orleans. He may even have known Bonn that well by then, who had not changed until then, and so would in all probability not change later. And he, Henry, who could not say to his friend, "I did that for love of you, do this for love of me." He couldn't say that, you see, this man, this youth, scarcely 20, who had turned his back upon all that he knew, to cast his lot with the single friend whom, even as they rode away that night, he must have known, as he knew that what his father had told him was true, that he was doomed and destined to kill. He must have known that just as he knew that his hope was vain. What hope and what for, he could not have said. What hope and dream of change in Bonn or in the situation? What dream that he could some day wake from and find it had been a dream? As in the injured man's fever dream, the dear suffering arm or leg is strong and sound, and only the well ones sick. It was Henry's probation, Henry holding all three of them in that durance to which even Judith acquiesced up to a certain point. She did not know what happened in the library that night. I don't think she ever did, suspected, until that afternoon 4 years later when she saw them again, when they brought Bond's body into the house and she found in his coat the photograph which was not her face, not her child. She just waked the next morning and they were gone, and only the letter, the note, remaining. The note written by Henry, since doubtless he refused to allow Bond to write. This announcement of the armistice, the probation, and Judith acquiescing up to that point, who would have refused as quickly to obey any injunction of her father as Henry had been to defy him, yet who did obey Henry in this matter, not the male relative, the brother, but because of that relationship between them, that single personality with two bodies, both of which had been seduced almost simultaneously by a man whom at the time Judith had never even seen. She and Henry both knowing that she would observe the probation, give him, Henry, the benefit of that interval, only up to that mutually recognized, though unstated and undefined point, and both doubtless aware that when that point was reached, she would, and with the same calm, the same refusal to accept or give because of any traditional weakness of sex, recall the armistice and face him as a foe. Not requiring or even wishing that Bond be present to support her, doubtless even refusing to allow him to intervene if he were, fighting the matter out with Henry like a man first before consenting to revert to the woman, the loved, the bride. And Bonn. Henry would have no more told Bonn what his father had told him than he would have returned to his father and told him that Bonn denied it. Since to do one, he would have to do the other, and he knew that Bonn's denial would be a lie. And though he could have borne Bonn's lie himself, he could not have borne for either Judith or his father to hear it. Besides, Henry would not need to tell Bonn what had happened. Bonn must have learned of Sutphen's visit to New Orleans as soon as he, Bonn, reached home that first summer. He must have known that Sutphen now knew his secret. If Bonn, until he saw Sutphen's reaction to it, ever looked upon it as a cause for secrecy, certainly not as a valid objection to marriage with a white woman, a situation in which probably all his contemporaries who could afford it were likewise involved, and which it would no more have occurred to him to mention to his bride or wife or to her family than he would have told them the secrets of a fraternal organization which he had joined before he married. In fact, the manner in which his intended bride's family reacted to the discovery of it was doubtless the first and last time when the Sutphen family ever surprised him. He is the curious one to me. He came into that isolated Puritan country household almost like Sutphen himself came into Jefferson, apparently complete, without background or past or childhood, a man a little older than his actual years and enclosed and surrounded by a sort of Scythian glitter, who seems to have seduced the country brother and sister without any effort or particular desire to do so, who caused all the pother and uproar, yet from the moment when he realized that Sutphen was going to prevent the marriage if he could, he, Bon, seems to have withdrawn into a mere spectator, passive, a little sardonic, and completely enigmatic. He seems to hover, shadowy, almost substanceless, a little behind and above all the other straightforward and logical, even though, to him, incomprehensible ultimatums and affirmations and defiances and challenges and repudiations, with an air of sardonic and indolent detachment, like that of a youthful Roman consul making the grand tour of his day among the barbarian hordes which his grandfather conquered, benighted in a brawling and childish and quite deadly mud castle household in a miasmic and spirit-ridden forest. It was as if he found the whole business, not inexplicable, of course, just unnecessary, that he knew at once that Sutphen had found out about the mistress and child, and he now found Sutphen's action and Henry's reaction a fetish-ridden moral blunderin' which did not deserve to be called thinkin', which he contemplated with the detached attentiveness of a scientist watching the muscles in an anesthetized frog, watching, contemplating them from behind that barrier of sophistication in comparison with which Henry and Sutphen were troglodytes. Not just the outside, the way he walked and talked and wore his clothes and handed Ellen into the dining room or into the carriage, and perhaps, probably, kissed her hand, and which Ellen envied for Henry, but the man himself, that fatalistic and impenetrable imperturbability with which he watched them while he waited for them to do whatever it would be that they would do, as if he had known all the while that the occasion would arise when he would have to wait, and that all he would need to do would be to wait. That he had seduced Henry and Judith both too thoroughly to have any fear that he might not marry Judith when he wished to. Not that stupid shrewdness, half instinct and half belief in luck, and half muscular habit of the senses and nerves of the gambler waiting to take what he can from what he sees, but a certain reserved and inflexible pessimism, stripped long generations ago of all the rubbish and claptrap of people, yes, Sutphen and Henry in the cold fields too, who have not quite yet emerged from barbarism, who 2,000 years hence will still be throwing triumphantly off the yoke of Latin culture and intelligence, of which they were never in any great permanent danger to begin with. Because he loved Judith, he would have added, doubtless, after his fashion, since, as his intended father-in-law soon learned, this was not the first time he had played this part, pledged what he had pledged to Judith, let alone the first time he would have gone through a ceremony to commemorate it, make what distinction, he was a Catholic of sorts, he might between this one with a white woman and that other. Because you will see the letter, not the first one he ever wrote to her, but at least the first, the only one she ever showed, as your grandmother knew then. And so we believe, now that she is dead, the only one which she kept, unless, of course, Miss Rosa or Clytie destroyed the others after she herself died. And this one here preserved not because Judith put it away to keep, but because she brought it herself and gave it to your grandmother after Bond's death, possibly on the same day when she destroyed the others which he had written her, provided, of course, it was she herself who destroyed them, which would have been when she found in Bond's coat the picture of the octoroon mistress and the little boy, because he was her first and last sweetheart. She must have seen him, in fact, with exactly the same eyes that Henry saw him with, and it would be hard to say to which of them he appeared the most splendid, to the one with hope, even though unconscious of making the image hers through possession, to the other with the knowledge, even though subconscious to the desire, of the insurmountable barrier which the similarity of gender hopelessly intervened. This man whom Henry first saw riding, perhaps through the grove at the university on one of the two horses which he kept there, or perhaps crossing the campus on foot in the slightly Frenchified cloak and hat which he wore, or perhaps, I like to think this, presented formally to the man reclining in a flowered, almost feminized gown, in a sunny window in his chambers. This man, handsome, elegant, and even cat-like, and too old to be where he was, too old not in years but in experience, with some tangible effluvium of knowledge, surfeit, of actions done and satiations plumbed and pleasures exhausted and even forgotten, so that he must have appeared, not only to Henry but to the entire undergraduate body of that small new provincial college, as a source not of envy, because you only envy whom you believe to be, but for accident, in no way superior to yourself, and what you believe, granted a little better luck than you have had heretofore, you will some day possess. Not of envy, but of despair, that sharp, shocking, terrible, hopeless despair of the young, which sometimes takes the form of insult toward, and even physical assault upon, the human subject of it, or, in extreme cases like Henry's, insult toward and assault upon any and all detractors of the subject, as witness Henry's violent repudiation of his father and his birthright when Sutphen forbade the marriage. Yes, he loved Bon, who seduced him as surely as he seduced Judith. The country boy, born and bred, who, with the 5 or 6 others of that small undergraduate body composed of other planters' sons, whom Bon permitted to become intimate with him, who aped his clothing and manner, and, to the extent which they were able, his very manner of living, looked upon Bon as though he were a hero out of some adolescent Arabian Nights, who had stumbled upon, or rather had thrust upon him, a talisman or touchstone, not to invest him with wisdom or power or wealth, but with the ability and opportunity to pass from the scene of one scarce imaginable delight to the next one without interval or pause or satiety. And the very fact that, lounging before them in the outlandish and almost feminine garments of his sybaritic privacy, he professed satiety, but increased not only the amazement but the bitter and hopeless outrage. Henry, the provincial, the clown almost, given to instinctive and violent action rather than to thinking, ratiocination, who may have been conscious that his fierce provincial's pride in his sister's virginity was a false quantity, which must incorporate in itself an inability to endure in order to be precious, to exist, and so must depend upon its loss, absence, to have existed at all. In fact, perhaps this is the pure and perfect incest, the brother realizing that the sister's virginity must be destroyed in order to have existed at all, taking that virginity in the person of the brother-in-law, the man whom he would be if he could become, metamorphose into, the lover, the husband, by whom he would be despoiled, choose for despoiler, if he could become, metamorphose into the sister, the mistress, the bride. Perhaps that is what went on, not in Henry's mind, but in his soul, because he never thought. He felt and acted immediately. He knew loyalty and acted it. He knew pride and jealousy. He loved, grieved, and killed, still grieving and, I believe, still loving Bon, the man to whom he gave 4 years of probation, 4 years in which to renounce and dissolve the other marriage, knowing that the 4 years of hoping and waiting would be in vain. Yes, Henry, not Bon, as witnessed the entire queerly placid course of Bon's and Judith's courtship. An engagement, if engagement it ever was, lasting for a whole year, yet comprising 2 holiday visits as her brother's guest, and which periods Bond seems to have spent either in riding and hunting with Henry, or as acting as an elegant and indolent esoteric hothouse bloom, possessing merely the name of a city for origin, history, and past, about which Ellen preened and fluttered out her unwitting butterflies Indian summer. He, the living man, was usurped, you see. There was no time, no interval, no niche in the crowded days when he could have courted Judith. You cannot even imagine him and Judith alone together. Try to do it, and the nearest you can come is a projection of them while the 2 actual people were doubtless separate and elsewhere. 2 shades pacing, serene and untroubled by flesh in a summer garden. The same 2 serene phantoms who seemed to watch, hover, impartial, attentive, and quiet, above and behind the inexplicable thunderhead of interdictions and defiances and repudiations, out of which the rock-like Sutphen and the volatile and violent Henry flashed and glared and ceased. Henry, who up to that time had never even been to Memphis, who had never been away from home before that September when he went to the university with his countrified clothes and his saddle horse and negro groom. The six or seven of them, of an age and background, only in the surface matter of food and clothing and daily occupation, any different from the negro slaves who supported them. The same sweat. The only difference being that on the one hand it went for labor in fields, where on the other it went as the price of the spartan and meager pleasures which were available to them because they did not have to sweat in the fields. The hard, violent hunting and riding. The same pleasures. The one, gambling for worn knives and brass jewelry and twists of tobacco and buttons and garments, because they happened to be easiest and quickest to hand. On the other, for the money and horses, the guns and watches, and for the same reason. The same parties, the identical music from identical instruments, crude fiddles and guitars, now in the big house with candles and silk dresses and champagne, now in the dirt-floored cabins with smoke and pine knots and calico and water sweetened with molasses. It was Henry, because at that time Bond had not even seen Judith. He had probably not paid enough attention to Henry's inarticulate recounting of his brief and conventional background and history to have remembered that Henry had a sister. This indolent man, too old to find even companionship among the youths, the children, with whom he now lived. This man miscast for the time and knowing it, accepting it for a reason obviously good enough to cause him to endure it and apparently too serious or at least too private to be divulged to what acquaintances he now possessed. This man, who later showed the same indolence, almost uninterest, the same detachment when the uproar about that engagement, which, so far as Jefferson knew, never formally existed, which Bond himself never affirmed or denied, arose, and he in the background, impartial and passive, as though it were not himself involved, or he acting on behalf of some absent friend, but as though the person involved and interdict were someone whom he had never heard of and cared nothing about. There does not even seem to have been any courtship. Apparently he paid Judith the dubious compliment of not even trying to ruin her, let alone insisting on the marriage either before or after Sutphen forbade it. This, mind you, in a man who had already acquired a name for prowess among women while at the university, long before Sutphen was to find actual proof. No engagement, no courtship even. He and Judith saw one another 3 times in 2 years for a total period of 12 days, counting the time Ellen consumed. They parted without even saying goodbye. And yet 4 years later Henry had to kill Bond to keep them from marrying. So it must have been Henry who seduced Judith, not Bond. Seduced her along with himself from that distance between Oxford and Sutphen's Hundred, between herself and the man whom she had not even seen yet. As though by means of that telepathy with which as children they seemed at times to anticipate one another's actions as 2 birds leave a limb at the same instant. That rapport, not like the conventional delusion of that between twins, but rather such as might exist between 2 people who, regardless of sex or age or heritage of race or tongue, had been marooned at birth on a desert island. The island here, Sutphen's Hundred. The solitude, the shadow of that father, with whom not only the town, but their mother's family as well, had merely assumed armistice, rather than accepting and assimilating. You see, there they are. This girl, this young country-bred girl who sees a man for an average of 1 hour a day for 12 days during his life, and that over a period of 1.5 years, yet is bent on marrying him to the extent of forcing her brother to the last resort of homicide, even if not murder, to prevent it, and that after a period of 4 years during which she could not have been always certain that he was still alive. This father, who should see that man 1 time, yet have reason to make a 600-mile journey to investigate him, and either discover what he already and apparently by clairvoyance suspected, or at least something which served just as well as reason for forbidding the marriage. This brother, in whose eyes that sister's and daughter's honor and happiness, granted that curious and unusual relationship which existed between them, should have been more jealous and precious than to the father even, yet who must champion the marriage to the extent of repudiating the father and blood and home, to become a follower and dependent of the rejected suitor for 4 years before killing him, apparently for the very identical reason which 4 years ago he quitted home to champion. And this lover, who apparently without volition or desire became involved in an engagement which he seems neither to have sought nor avoided, who took his dismissal in the same passive and sardonic spirit, yet 4 years later was apparently so bent upon the marriage to which up to that time he had been completely indifferent, as to force the brother who had championed it to kill him to prevent it. Yes, granted that even to the unworldly Henry, let alone the more travelled father, the existence of the 8th part Negro mistress and the 16th part Negro son, granted even the morganatic ceremony, a situation which was as much a part of a wealthy young New Orleansian's social and fashionable equipment as his dancing slippers, was reason enough, which is drawing on a little fine even for the shadowy paragons which are our ancestors born in the South and come to man and womanhood about 1860 or 61. It's just incredible. It just does not explain. Or perhaps that's it. They don't explain, and we are not supposed to know. We have a few old mouth-to-mouth tales. We exhume from old trunks and boxes and drawers letters without salutation or signature, in which men and women who once lived and breathed are now mere initials or nicknames out of some now incomprehensible affection, which sound to us like Sanskrit or Choctaw. We see dimly people, the people in whose living blood and seed we ourselves lay dormant and waiting, in this shadowy attenuation of time, possessing now heroic proportions, performing their acts of simple passion and simple violence, impervious to time and inexplicable. Yes, Judith, Bond, Henry, Sutphen, all of them. They are there, yet something is missing. They are like a chemical formula exhumed along with the letters from that forgotten chest, carefully, the paper old and faded and fallen to pieces, the writing faded, almost indecipherable, yet meaningful, familiar in shape and sense, the name and presence of volatile and sentient forces. You bring them together in the proportions called for, but nothing happens. You reread, tedious and intent, poring, making sure that you have forgotten nothing, made no miscalculation. You bring them together again and again, nothing happens. Just the words, the symbols, the shapes themselves, shadowy and inscrutable and serene, against that turgid background of a horrible and bloody mischancing of human affairs. They came from the university to spend that first Christmas. Judith and Ellen and Sutphen saw him for the first time. Judith, the man whom she was to see for an elapsed time of 12 days, yet to remember so that 4 years later, he never wrote her during that time, Henry would not let him, it was the probation, you see. When she received a letter from him saying, "We have waited long enough," she and Clytie should begin at once to fashion a wedding dress and veil out of rags and scraps. Ellen, the esoteric, the almost baroque, the almost epicene of J. Dar, which, with childlike veracity, she essayed to include in the furnishing and decoration of her house. Sutphen, the man whom, after seeing once and before any engagement existed anywhere save in his wife's mind, he saw as a potential threat to the, now and at last, triumphant coronation of his old hardships and ambition, of which threat he was apparently sure enough to warrant a 600-mile journey to prove it. This in a man who might have challenged and shot someone whom he disliked or feared, but who would not have made even a 10-mile journey to investigate him. You see, you would almost believe that Sutphen's trip to New Orleans was just sheer chance. Just a little more of the illogical machinations of a fatality which had chosen that family in preference to any other in the county or the land, exactly as a small boy chooses one anthill to pour boiling water into in preference to any other, not even himself knowing why. They stayed 2 weeks and rode back to school, stopping to see Miss Rosa, but she was not at home. They passed the long term before the summer vacation, talking together and riding and reading. Bond was reading law. He would be, would almost have to, since only that could have made his residence bearable, regardless of what reason he may have brought with him for remaining. This, the perfect setting for his dilatory indolence, this digging into musty Blackstone and Coke, where, of an undergraduate body still numbered in two figures, the law school probably consisted of six others beside Henry. Yes, he corrupted Henry to the law also. Henry changed in midterm. And himself. While Henry aped his clothing and speech, caricatured rather, perhaps. And Bonn, though he had now seen Judith, very likely the same lazy and cat-like man, and it Henry who foisted upon him now the role of his sister's intended, as during the fall term Henry and his companions had foisted upon Bonn the role of Lothario. And Ellen and Judith now shopping 2 and 3 times a week in town, and stopping once to see Miss Rosa while on their way by carriage to Memphis, with a wagon preceding them to fetch back the plunder, and an extra nigger on the box with the coachman to stop every few miles and build a fire and reheat the bricks on which Ellen's and Judith's feet rested. Shopping, buying the trousseau for that wedding whose formal engagement existed nowhere yet save in Ellen's mind. And Supfin, who had seen Bonn once and was in New Orleans investigating him when Bonn next entered the house, who knows what he was thinking. What waiting for, what moment, day, to go to New Orleans and find what he seems to have known all the while that he would find. There was no one for him to tell, talk to about it, about his fear and suspicion. He trusted no man nor woman, who had no man's nor woman's love, since Ellen was incapable of love and Judith was too much like him. And he must have seen at a glance that Bonn, even though the daughter might still be saved from him, had already corrupted the son. He had been too successful, you see. His was that solitude of contempt and distrust which success brings to him who gained it because he was strong, instead of merely lucky. Then June came, and the end of the school year, and Henry and Bonn returned to Supfin's Hundred, Bonn to spend a day or two before riding on to the river to take the steamboat home, to New Orleans, where Supfin had already gone, though none knew it, least of all Ellen. He stayed but 2 days, yet now if ever was his chance to come to an understanding with Judith, perhaps even to fall in love with her. It was his only chance, his last chance, though of course neither he nor Judith could have known it, since Supfin, though but 2 weeks absent from home, had doubtless already found out about the octoroon mistress and the child. So for the first and last time Bonn and Judith might have been said to have a free field. Might have been, since it was really Ellen who had the free field. I can imagine her engineering that courtship, supplying Judith and Bonn with opportunities for trysts and pledges, with a coy and unflagging ubiquity which they must have tried in vain to evade and escape. Judith with annoyed yet still serene concern, Bonn with that sardonic and surprised distaste which seems to have been the ordinary manifestation of the impenetrable and shadowy character. Yes, shadowy, a myth, a phantom, something which they engendered and created whole themselves, some effluvium of Supfin blood and character, as though as a man he did not exist at all. Yet there was the body which Miss Rosa saw, which Judith buried in the family plot beside her mother, and this, the fact that even an undefined and never-spoken engagement survived, speaking well for the postulation that they did love one another, since during that 2 days mere romance would have perished, died of sheer saccharinity and opportunity. Then Bonn rode on to the river and took the boat. And now this. Who knows, perhaps if Henry had gone with him that summer instead of waiting until the next, Bonn would not have had to die as he did. If Henry had only gone then to New Orleans and found out then about the mistress and the child. Henry, who, before it was too late, might have reacted to the discovery exactly as Supfin did, as a jealous brother might have been expected to react, since who knows but what it was not the fact of the mistress and child, the possible bigamy to which Henry gave the lie, but to the fact that it was his father who told him, his father who anticipated him, the father who is the natural enemy of any son and son-in-law of whom the mother is the ally. Just as after the wedding the father will be the ally of the actual son-in-law who has for mortal foe the mother of his wife. But Henry did not go this time. He rode to the river with Bonn and then returned. After a time Supfin returned home too, from where and for what purpose, none were to know, until the next Christmas, and that summer passed, the last summer of peace and content, with Henry, doubtless without deliberate intent, pleading Bond's suit far better than Bond, than that indolent fatalist had ever bothered to plead it himself, and Judith listening with that serenity, that impenetrable tranquillity which a year or so before had been the young girl's vague and pointless and dreamy unvolition, but was now already a mature woman's, a mature woman in love, repose. That's when the letters came, and Henry reading them all without jealousy, with that complete abnegan transference, metamorphosis, into the body which was to become his sister's lover. And Sutphen saying nothing yet about what he had learned in New Orleans, but just waiting, unsuspected even by Henry and Judith. Waiting for what nobody knows, perhaps in the hope that when Bond learned, as he would be obliged to, that Sutphen had discovered his secret, he, Bond, would realize that the game was up and not even return to school the next year. But Bond did return. He and Henry met again at the university. The letters, from Henry and Bond both now, making weekly journeys by the hand of Henry's groom. And Sutphen still waiting. Certainly no one could say for what now. Incredible that he should wait for Christmas, for the crisis to come to him. This man of whom it was said that he not only went out to meet his troubles, he sometimes went out and manufactured them. But this time he waited, and it came to him. Christmas. And Henry and Bond rode again to Sutphen's Hundred, and even the town convinced now by Ellen that the engagement existed. That 24th of December, 1860, and the nigger children, with branches of mistletoe and holly for excuses, already lurking about the rear of the big house to shout, "Christmas gift!" at the white people. The rich city man come to court Judith. And Sutphen saying nothing even yet. Not suspected yet, unless possibly by Henry, possibly Henry who brought the matter to its crisis that same night. And Ellen, at the absolute flood's peak of her unreal and weightless life, which with the next dawn was to break beneath her and wash her, spent, amazed, and uncomprehending, into the shuttered room where she died 2 years later. The Christmas Eve, the explosion, and none to ever know just why or just what happened between Henry and his father, and only the cabin-to-cabin whispering of negroes to spread the news that Henry and Bond had ridden away in the dark, and that Henry had formally abjured his home and birthright. They went to New Orleans. They rode through the bright cold of that Christmas day, to the river, and took the steamboat. It's still Henry doing the leading, the bringing, as he always did until the very last, when for the first time during their entire relationship Bond led and Henry followed. He didn't have to go. He had voluntarily made himself a pauper, but he could have gone to his grandfather, since although he was probably better mounted than any other at the university, not excepting Bond himself, he probably had very little money beyond what he could raise hurriedly on his horse and what valuables he happened to have on his body when he and Bond rode away. No, he didn't have to go. And he doing the leading this time, too, and Bond riding beside him trying to find out from him what had happened. Bond knew, of course, what Sutphen had discovered in New Orleans, but he would need to know just what, just how much Sutphen had told Henry. And Henry not telling him, doubtless with the new mare, which he probably knew he would have to surrender, sacrifice to, along with all the rest of his life, inheritance, going fast now and his back rigid and irrevocably turned upon the house, his birthplace and all the familiar scenes of his childhood and youth which he had repudiated for the sake of that friend with whom, despite the sacrifice which he had just made out of love and loyalty, he still could not be perfectly frank. Because he knew that what Sutphen had told him was true. He must have known that at the very instant when he gave his father the lie. So he dared not ask Bond to deny it. He dared not, you see. He could face poverty, disinheritance, but he could not have borne that lie from Bond. Yet he went to New Orleans. He went straight there, to the only place, the very place, where he could not help but prove conclusively the very statement which, coming from his father, he had called a lie. He went there for that purpose. He went there to prove it. And Bond, riding beside him, trying to find out what Sutphen had told him. Bond, who for a year and a half now had been watching Henry ape his clothing and speech, who for a year and a half now had seen himself as the object of that complete and abnegant devotion which only a youth, never a woman, gives to another youth or a man, who for exactly a year now had seen the sister succumb to that same spell which the brother had already succumbed to, and this with no volition on the seducer's part, without so much as the lifting of a finger, as though it actually were the brother who had put the spell on the sister, seduced her to his own vicarious image which walked and breathed with Bond's body. Yet here is the letter, sent 4 years afterward, written on a sheet of paper salvaged from a gutted house in Carolina, with stove polish found in some captured Yankee stores. 4 years after she had had any message from him save the messages from Henry that he, Bond, was still alive. So whether Henry now knew about the other woman or not, he would now have to know. Bond realized that. I can imagine them as they rode, Henry still in the fierce repercussive flush of vindicated loyalty, and Bond, the wiser, the shrewder, even if only from wider experience and a few more years of age, learning from Henry without Henry's being aware of it what Sutphen had told him. Because Henry would have to know now. And I don't believe it was just to preserve Henry as an ally, for the crisis of some future need. It was because Bond not only loved Judith after his fashion, but he loved Henry too. And I believe in a deeper sense than merely after his fashion. Perhaps in his fatalism he loved Henry the better of the two, seeing perhaps in the sister merely the shadow, the woman vessel with which to consummate the love whose actual object was the youth. This cerebral Don Juan, who, reversing the order, had learned to love what he had injured. Perhaps it was even more than Judith or Henry either. Perhaps the life, the existence which they represented. Because who knows what picture of peace he might have seen in that monotonous provincial backwater? What alleviation and escape for a parched traveler who had traveled too far at too young an age in this granite-bound and simple country spring. And I can imagine how Bond told Henry, broke it to him. I can imagine Henry in New Orleans, who had not yet even been to Memphis, whose entire worldly experience consisted of sojourns at other houses, plantations almost interchangeable with his own, where he followed the same routine which he did at home, the same hunting and cockfighting, the same amateur racing of horses on crude homemade tracks, horses sound enough in blood and lineage yet not bred to race, and perhaps not even 30 minutes out of the shafts of a trap or perhaps even a carriage, the same square dancing with identical and also interchangeable provincial virgins, to music exactly like that at home, the same champagne, the best, doubtless, yet crudely dispensed out of the burlesque pantomime elegance of Negro butlers who, and likewise the drinkers who gulped it down like neat whiskey between flowery and unsubtle toasts, would have treated lemonade the same way. I can imagine him, with his Puritan heritage, that heritage peculiarly Anglo-Saxon, of fierce, proud mysticism, and that ability to be ashamed of ignorance and inexperience, in that city foreign and paradoxical, with its atmosphere at once fatal and languorous, at once feminine and steel-hard, this grim, humorless yokel out of a granite heritage where even the houses, let alone clothing and conduct, are built in the image of a jealous and sadistic Jehovah, put suddenly down in a place whose denizens had created their all-powerful and his supporting hierarchy chorus of beautiful saints and handsome angels in the image of their houses and personal ornaments and voluptuous lives. Yes, I can imagine how Bond led up to it, to the shock, the skill, the calculation, preparing Henry's Puritan mind as he would have prepared a cramped and rocky field and planted it and raised the crop which he wanted. It would be the fact of the ceremony, regardless of what kind, that Henry would balk at. Bond knew this. It would not be the mistress or even the child, not even the Negro mistress and even less the child, because of that fact, since Henry and Judith had grown up with a Negro half-sister of their own. Not the mistress to Henry, certainly not the nigger mistress to a youth with Henry's background, a young man grown up and living in a milieu where the other sex is separated into 3 sharp divisions, separated, 2 of them, by a chasm which could be crossed but one time and in but one direction, ladies, women, females, the virgins whom gentlemen some day married, the courtesans to whom they went while on sabbaticals to the cities, the slave girls and women upon whom that first cast rested, and to whom in certain cases it doubtless owed the very fact of its virginity. Not this to Henry, young, strong-blooded, victim of the hard celibacy of riding and hunting, to heat and make importunate the blood of a young man, to which he and his kind were forced to pass time away, with girls of his own class interdict and inaccessible, and women of the second class just as inaccessible because of money and distance, and hence only the slave girls, the housemaids kneaded and cleaned by white mistresses, or perhaps girls with sweating bodies out of the fields themselves, and the young man rides up and beckons the watching overseer and says, "Send me Juno, or Miss Elena, or Chlory," and then rides on into the trees and dismounts and waits. No, it would be the ceremony. A ceremony entered into, to be sure, with a negro, yet still a ceremony. This is what Bond doubtless thought. So I can imagine him, the way he did it, the way in which he took the innocent and negative plate of Henry's provincial soul and intellect, and exposed it by slow degrees to this esoteric milieu, building gradually toward the picture which he desired it to retain, accept. I can see him corrupting Henry gradually into the purlieus of elegance, with no forward, no warning, the postulation to come after the fact, exposing Henry slowly to the surface aspect. The architecture, a little curious, a little femininely flamboyant, and therefore, to Henry, opulent, sensuous, sinful. The inference of great and easy wealth measured by steamboat loads in place of a tedious inching of sweating human figures across cotton fields. The flash and glitter of a myriad carriage wheels, in which women, enthroned and immobile and passing rapidly across the vision, appeared like painted portraits beside men in linen a little finer and diamonds a little brighter, and in broadcloth a little trimmer, and with hats raked a little more above faces a little more darkly swaggering than any Henry had ever seen before. And the mentor, the man for whose sake he had repudiated not only blood and kin, but food and shelter and clothing too, whose clothing and walk and speech he had tried to ape, along with his attitude toward women and his ideas of honor and pride too, watching him with that cold and cat-like inscrutable calculation, watching the picture resolve and become fixed, and then telling Henry, "But that's not it, that's just the base, the foundation. It can belong to anyone." And Henry, "You mean this is not it? That it is above this, higher than this, more select than this?" And Bond, "Yes, this is only the foundation. This belongs to anybody." A dialogue without words, speech, which would fix and then remove without obliterating one line the picture, this background, leaving the background, the plate prepared and innocent again, the plate docile, with that Puritan's humility toward anything which is a matter of sense rather than logic, fact. The man, the struggling and suffocating heart behind it saying, "I will believe, I will, whether it is true or not, I will believe." Waiting for the next picture which the mentor, the corrupter, intended for it. That next picture, following the fixation and acceptance of which the mentor would say again, perhaps with words now, still watching the sober and thoughtful face, but still secure in his knowledge and trust in that Puritan heritage, which must show disapproval instead of surprise or even despair, and nothing at all rather than have the disapprobation construed as surprise or despair. "But even this is not it. And Henry, you mean it is still higher than this, still above this?" Because he, Bond, would be talking now, lazily, almost cryptically, stroking onto the plate himself now the picture which he wanted there. I can imagine how he did it. The calculation, the surgeon's alertness and cold detachment, the exposures brief, so brief as to be cryptic, almost staccato, the plate unaware of what the complete picture would show, scarce seen yet ineradicable. A trap. A riding horse standing before a closed and curiously monastic doorway in a neighborhood a little decadent, even a little sinister, and Vaughn mentioning the owner's name casually. This corruption subtly anew by putting into Henry's mind the notion of one man of the world speaking to another, that Henry knew that Vaughn believed that Henry would know, even from a disjointed word, what Vaughn was talking about. And Henry the Puritan, who must show nothing at all rather than surprise or incomprehension. A facade shuttered and blank, drowsing in steamy morning sunlight, invested by the bland and cryptic voice with something of secret and curious and unimaginable delights. Without his knowing what he saw, it was as though to Henry the blank and scaling barrier in dissolving produced and revealed not comprehension to the mind, the intellect, which weighs and discards, but striking instead straight and true to some primary blind and mindless foundation of all young male living dream and hope. A row of faces like a bazaar of flowers, the supreme apotheosis of chattelry, of human flesh bred of the two races for that sale. A corridor of doomed and tragic flower faces walled between the grim duenna row of old women and the elegant shapes of young men, trim, predatory, and, at the moment, goat-like. This scene by Henry quickly, exposed quickly and then removed, the mentor's voice, still bland, pleasant, cryptic, postulating still the fact of one man of the world talking to another about something they both understand, depending upon, counting upon still, the Puritan's provincial horror of revealing surprise or ignorance, who knew Henry so much better than Henry knew him, and Henry not showing either, suppressing still that first cry of terror and grief, "I will believe, I will, I will!" Yes, that brief, before Henry had had time to know what he had seen, but now slowing, now would come the instant for which Bond had builded. A wall, unscalable, a gate ponderously locked, the sober and thoughtful country youth just waiting, looking, not yet asking why or what, the gate of solid beams in place of the lace-like iron grilling. And they passing on, Bond knocking at a small adjacent doorway from which a swarthy man resembling a creature out of an old woodcut of the French Revolution erupts, concerned, even a little aghast, looking first at the daylight and then at Henry, and speaking to Bond in French which Henry does not understand, and Bond's teeth glinting for an instant before he answers in French, "With him? An American? He is a guest. I would have to let him choose weapons, and I decline to fight with axes. No, no, not that. Just the key." Just the key. And now the solid gates closed behind them instead of before. No sight or evidence above the high thick walls of the low city, and scarce any sound of it. The labyrinthine mass of oleander and jasmine, lantana and mimosa, walling yet again the strip of bare earth, combed and curried with powdered shell, raked and immaculate, and only the most recent of the brown stains showing now. And the voice, the mentor, the guide, standing aside now to watch the grave provincial face, casually and pleasantly anecdotal. "The customary way is to stand back to back, the pistol in your right hand and the corner of the other cloak in your left. Then, at the signal, you begin to walk, and when you feel the cloak tauten, you turn and fire. Though there are some now and then, when the blood is especially hot or when it is still peasant blood, who prefer knives and one cloak. They face one another inside the same cloak, you see, each holding the other's wrist with the left hand. But that was never my way." Casual, chatty, you see, waiting for the countryman's slow question, who knew already now before he asked it. "What would you, they, be fighting for?" Yes, Henry would know now, or believe that he knew now. Any more he would probably consider anticlimax, though it would not be. It would be anything but that. The final blow, stroke, touch, the keen surgeon-like compounding which the now shocked nerves of the patient would not even feel, not know that the first hard shocks were the random and crude. Because there was that ceremony, Bond knew that that would be what Henry would resist, find hard to stomach and retain. Oh, he was shrewd. This man whom for weeks now Henry was realizing that he knew less and less. This stranger, immersed and oblivious now in the formal, almost ritual preparations for the visit, Finnegan, almost like a woman over the fit of the new coat which he would have ordered for Henry, forced Henry to accept for this occasion, by means of which the entire impression which Henry was to receive from the visit would be established before they even left the house, before Henry ever saw the woman. And Henry, the countryman, the bewildered, with the subtle tide already setting beneath him toward the point where he must either betray himself and his entire upbringing and thinking, or deny the friend for whom he had already repudiated home and kin and all, the bewildered, the, for that time, helpless, who wanted to believe yet did not see how he could, being carried by the friend, the mentor, through one of those inscrutable and curiously lifeless doorways, like that before which he had seen the horse or the trap, and so into a place which to his Puritan's provincial mind all of morality was upside down and all of honor perished. A place created for and by voluptuousness, the abashless and unabashed senses. And the country boy, with his simple and erstwhile untroubled code in which females were ladies or whores or slaves, looked at the apotheosis of two doomed races presided over by its own victim. A woman with a face like a tragic magnolia, the eternal female, the eternal who suffers. The child, the boy, sleeping in silk and lace to be sure, yet complete chattel of him who, begetting him, owned him body and soul to sell, if he chose, like a calf or puppy or sheep. And the mentor watching again, perhaps even the gambler now, thinking, have I won or lost, as they emerged and returned to Bond's rooms. For that while impotent, even with talk, shrewdness, no longer counting upon that Puritan character, which must show neither surprise nor despair, having to count now, if on anything, on the corruption itself, the love. He could not even say, well, what do you say about it? He could only wait, and that upon the absolutely unpredictable actions of a man who lived by instinct and not reason, until Henry should speak, but a bought woman, a whore. And Bond, even gently now, not whore, don't say that. In fact, never refer to one of them by that name in New Orleans. Otherwise you may be forced to purchase that privilege with some of your blood from probably 1,000 men. And perhaps still gently, perhaps now even with something of pity, that pessimistic and sardonic cerebral pity of the intelligent for any human injustice or folly or suffering. Not whores, and not whores because of us, the thousand. We, the thousand, the white men, made them, created and produced them. We even made the laws which declare that 1/8 of a specified kind of blood shall outweigh 7/8 of another kind. I admit that. But that same white race would have made them slaves, too, laborers, cooks, maybe even field hands, if it were not for this thousand, these few men like myself, without principles, or honor either, perhaps you will say. We cannot, perhaps we do not even want to save all of them. Perhaps the thousand we save are not 1 in 1,000. But we save that one. God may mock every sparrow, but we do not pretend to be God, you see. Perhaps we do not even want to be God, since no man would want but one of these sparrows. And perhaps when God looks into one of these establishments like you saw tonight, he would not choose one of us to be God either, now that he is old. Though he must have been young once, surely he was young once, and surely someone who has existed as long as he has, who has looked at as much crude and promiscuous sinning without grace or restraint or decorum as he has had to contemplate at last, even though the instances are not 1 in 1,000,000, the principles of honor, decorum, and gentleness applied to perfectly normal human instinct, which you Anglo-Saxons insist upon calling lust, and in whose service you revert in sabbaticals to the primordial caverns, the fall from what you call grace, fogged and clouded by heaven-defying words of extenuation and explanation, the return to grace heralded by heaven-placating cries of satiated abasement and flagellation, in neither of which, the defiance or the placation, can heaven find interest, or even, after the first 2 or 3 times, diversion. So perhaps now that God is an old man, he is not interested in the way we serve what you call lust either. Perhaps he does not even require of us that we save this one sparrow, any more than we save the one sparrow which we do save for any commendation from him. But we do save that one, who but for us would have been sold to any brute who had the price, not sold to him for the night like a white prostitute, but body and soul for life to him who could have used her with more impunity than he would dare to use an animal, heifer or mare, and then discarded or sold or even murdered when worn out or when her keep and her price no longer balanced. Yes, a sparrow which God himself neglected to mark, because though men, white men, created her, God did not stop it. He planted the seed which brought her to flower, the white blood to give the shape and pigment of what the white man calls female beauty, to a female principle which existed, queenly and complete, in the hot equatorial groin of the world long before that white one of ours came down from trees and lost its hair and bleached out. A principle apt, docile, and instinct with strange and ancient curious pleasures of the flesh, which is all, there is nothing else, which her white sisters of a mushroom yesterday flee from in moral and outraged horror. A principle which, where her white sister must needs try to make an economic matter of it, like someone who insists upon installing a counter or a scales or a safe in a store or business for a certain percentage of the profits, reigns, wise, supine, and all-powerful, from the sunless and silken bed which is her throne. No, not whores, not even courtesans. Creatures taken at childhood, culled and chosen and raised more carefully than any white girl, any nun, than any blooded mare even, by a person who gives them the unsleeping care and attention which no mother ever gives.
This book is continued on Disc 4.
No, not whores, not even courtesans. Creatures taken at childhood, culled and chosen and raised more carefully than any white girl, any nun, than any blooded mare even, by a person who gives them the unsleeping care and attention which no mother ever gives. For a price, of course, but a price offered and accepted or declined through a system more formal than any that white girls are sold under, since they are more valuable as commodities than white girls, raised and trained to fulfill a woman's sole end and purpose, to love, to be beautiful, to divert, never to see a man's face hardly until brought to the ball and offered to and chosen by some man who in return, not can and not will but must, supply her with the surroundings proper in which to love and be beautiful and divert, and who must usually risk his life, or at least his blood, for that privilege. No, not whores. Sometimes I believe that they are the only true chaste women, not to say virgins, in America, and they remain true and faithful to that man not merely until he dies or frees them, but until they die. And where will you find whore or lady either whom you can count on to do that? And Henry... But you married her, you married her. And, Bon, it would be a little quicker now, sharper now, though still gentle, still patient, though still the iron, the steel, the gambler not quite yet reduced to his final trump. Ah, that ceremony, I see, that's it then. A formula, a shibboleth, meaningless as a child's game, performed by someone created by the situation whose need it answered. A crone mumbling in a dungeon lighted by a handful of burning hair, something in a tongue which not even the girls themselves understand any more, maybe not even the crone herself, rooted in nothing of economics for her or for any possible progeny, since the very fact that we acquiesced, suffered the farce, was her proof and assurance of that which the ceremony itself could never enforce. Vesting no new rights in anyone, denying to none the old, a ritual as meaningless as that of college boys in secret rooms at night, even to the same archaic and forgotten symbols. You call that a marriage? When the night of a honeymoon and the casual business with a hired prostitute consists of the same suzerainty over a temporarily private room, the same order of removing the same clothes, the same conjunction in a single bed? Why not call that a marriage, too? And Henry, "Oh, I know, I know. You give me 2 and 2, and you tell me it makes 5, and it does make 5. But there is still the marriage. Suppose I assume an obligation to a man who cannot speak my language, the obligation stated to him in his own, and I agree to it. Am I any the less obligated because I did not happen to know the tongue in which he accepted me in good faith? No. The more, the more." And Bond, the trump now, the voice gentle now, "Have you forgot that this woman, this child, are niggers? You, Henry Sutphen of Sutphen's Hundred in Mississippi, you talking of marriage, a wedding, here?" And Henry, the despair now, the last bitter cry of irrevocable defeat. "Yes, I know that, but it's still there. It's not right. Not even you doing it makes it right. Not even you." So that was all. It should have been all. That afternoon 4 years later should have happened the next day. The 4 years, the interval, mere anticlimax. An attenuation and prolongation of a conclusion already ripe to happen. By the war, by a stupid and bloody aberration in the high and impossible destiny of the United States, maybe instigated by that family fatality which possessed, along with all circumstance, that curious lack of economy between cause and effect which is always a characteristic of fate when reduced to using human beings for tools, material. Anyway, Henry waited 4 years, holding the three of them in that abeyance, that durance, waiting, hoping for Bond to renounce the woman and dissolve the marriage which he, Henry, admitted was no marriage, and which he must have known as soon as he saw the woman and the child that Bond would not renounce. In fact, as time passed and Henry became accustomed to the idea of that ceremony which was still no marriage, that may have been the trouble with Henry. Not the two ceremonies, but the two women. Not the fact that Bond's intention was to commit bigamy, but that it was apparently to make his, Henry's, sister a sort of junior partner in a harem. Anyway, he waited, hoped, for 4 years. That spring they returned north into Mississippi. Bull Run had been fought, and there was a company organizing at the university among the student body. Henry and Bond joined it. Probably Henry wrote Judith where they were and what they intended to do. They enlisted together, you see, Henry watching Bond and Bond permitting himself to be watched, the probation, the durance, the one who dared not let the other out of his sight, not from fear that Bond would marry Judith with Henry not there to stop it, but that Bond would marry Judith and then he, Henry, would have to live for the rest of his life with the knowledge that he was glad that he had been so betrayed, with the coward's joy of surrendering without having been vanquished. The other, for that same reason, too, who could not have wanted Judith without Henry, since he must never have doubted but what he could marry Judith when he wished, in spite of brother and father both. Because, as I said before, it was not Judith who was the object of Bond's love or of Henry's solicitude. She was just the blank shape, the empty vessel in which each of them strove to preserve, not the illusion of himself nor his illusion of the other, but what each conceived the other to believe him to be. The man and the youth, seducer and seduced, who had known one another, seduced and been seduced, victimized in turn each by the other, conqueror vanquished by his own strength, vanquished conquering by his own weakness, before Judith came into their joint lives even by so much as girl name. And who knows? There was the war now. Who knows but what the fatality and the fatality's victims did not both think, hope, that the war would settle the matter, leave free one of the two irreconcilables, since it would not be the first time that youth has taken catastrophe as a direct act of providence for the sole purpose of solving a personal problem which youth itself could not solve. And Judith, how else to explain her but this way? Surely Bond could not have corrupted her to fatalism in 12 days, who not only had not tried to corrupt her to unchastity, but not even to defy her father. No, anything but a fatalist, who was the Sutphen with the ruthless Sutphen code of taking what it wanted, provided it was strong enough. Of the two children, as Henry was the cold field, with the cold field cluttering of morality and rules of right and wrong, who, while Henry screamed and vomited, looked down from the loft that night on the spectacle of Sutphen fighting half-naked with one of his half-naked niggers with the same cold and attentive interest with which Sutphen would have watched Henry fighting with a negro boy of his own age and weight, because she could not have known the reason for her father's objection to the marriage. Henry would not have told her, and she would not have asked her father, because even if she had known it, it would have made no difference to her. She would have acted as Sutphen would have acted with anyone who tried to cross him. She would have taken Barn anyway. I can imagine her, if necessary, even murdering the other woman. But she certainly would have made no investigation and then held a moral debate between what she wanted and what she thought was right. Yet she waited. She waited 4 years, with no word from him save through Henry that he, Barn, was alive. Because Henry would not let Barn write her. He would not have, and Barn would not have tried to. It was the probation, the durance. They all three accepted it. I don't believe there was ever any promise between Henry and Barn demanded or offered. But Judith, who could not have known what happened nor why. Have you noticed how so often when we try to reconstruct the causes which lead up to the actions of men and women, how with a sort of astonishment we find ourselves now and then reduced to the belief, the only possible belief, that they stemmed from some of the old virtues? The thief who steals not for greed but for love, the murderer who kills not out of lust but pity. Judith, giving implicit trust where she had given love, given implicit love where she had derived breath and pride. That true pride, not that false kind, which transforms what it does not at the moment understand into scorn and outrage, and so vents itself in pique and lacerations, but true pride, which can say to itself without abasement, I love, I will accept no substitute. Something has happened between him and my father. If my father was right, I will never see him again. If wrong, he will come or send for me. If happy I can be, I will. If suffer I must, I can. Because she waited, she made no effort to do anything else. Her relations with her father had not altered one jot. To see them together, Bond might never have even existed. The same two calm, impenetrable faces seen together in the carriage in town during the next few months after Ellen took to her bed, between that Christmas day and the day when Sutphen rode away with his and Sartorius's regiment. They didn't talk, tell one another anything, you see. Sutphen, what he had learned about Barn, Judith, that she knew where Barn and Henry now were. They did not need to talk. They were too much alike. They were as two people become now and then, who seem to know one another so well or are so much alike that the power, the need to communicate by speech, atrophies from disuse. And comprehending without need of the medium of ear or intellect, they no longer understand one another's actual words. So she did not tell him where Henry and Barn were, and he did not discover it until after the university company departed, because Barn and Henry enrolled and then hid themselves somewhere. They must have paused in Oxford only long enough to enroll before riding on, because no one who knew them either in Oxford or in Jefferson knew that they were members of the company at the time, which would have been almost impossible to conceal otherwise. Because now people, fathers and mothers and sisters and kin and sweethearts of those young men, were coming to Oxford from further away than Jefferson, families with food and bedding and servants, to bivouac among the families, the houses of Oxford itself, to watch the gallant mimic marching and countermarching of the sons and the brothers, drawn all of them, rich and poor, aristocrat and redneck, by what is probably the most moving mass sight of all human mass experience, far more so than the spectacle of so many virgins going to be sacrificed to some heathen principle, some priapus. The sight of young men, the light quick bones, the bright gallant deluded blood and flesh dressed in a martial glitter of brass and plumes, marching away to a battle. And there would be music at night, fiddle and triangle among the blazing candles, the blowing of curtains in tall windows on the April darkness, the swing of crinoline indiscriminate within the circle of plain gray cuff of the soldier, or the banded gold of rank, of an army, even if not a war, of gentlemen, where Private and Colonel called each other by their given names, not as one farmer to another across a halted plough in a field or across a counter in a store laden with calico and cheese and strap oil, but as one man to another above the suave, powdered shoulders of women, above the two raised glasses of scuppernong claret, or bought champagne. Music, the nightly repetitive last waltz as the days passed and the company waited to move, the brave trivial glitter against a black night not catastrophic but merely background, the perennial last scented spring of youth. And Judith not there, and Henry the romantic not there, and Bond the fatalist, hidden somewhere, the watcher and the watched. And the recurrent flower-laden dawns of that April and May and June filled with bugles, entering 100 windows where 100 still unbridled widows dreamed virgin unmeditant upon the locks of black or brown or yellow hair, and Judith not one of these. And 5 of the company, mounted with grooms and body-servants in a forage wagon, in their new and unstained gray, made a tour of the state with the flag, the company's colors, the segments of silk cut and fitted but not sewn, from house to house, until the sweetheart of each man in the company had taken a few stitches in it, and Henry and Bond not of these either, since they did not join the company until after it departed, who must have emerged from whatever place it was that they lurked in, emerging as though unnoticed from the roadside brake or thicket, to fall in as the marching company passed. The 2 of them, the youth and the man, the youth deprived twice now of his birthright, who should have made one among the candles and fiddles, the kisses and the desperate tears, who should have made one of the color guard itself which toured the state with the unsewn flag. And the man who should not have been there at all, who was too old to be there at all, both in years and experience. That mental and spiritual orphan whose fate it apparently was to exist in some limbo, halfway between where his corporeality was and his mentality and moral equipment desired to be. An undergraduate at the university, yet by the sheer accumulation of 2 full years behind him, forced into the extra-academic of a law class containing 6 members. In the war, by that same force, removed into the isolation of commissioned rank. He received a lieutenancy before the company entered its first engagement, even. I don't think he wanted it. I can even imagine him trying to avoid it, refuse it. But there it was, he was, orphaned once more by the very situation to which and by which he was doomed. The 2 of them officer and man now, but still watcher and watched, waiting for something but not knowing what. What act of fate, destiny, what irrevocable sentence of what judge or arbiter between them, since nothing less would do, nothing halfway or reversible would seem to suffice. The officer, the lieutenant, who possessed the slight and authorized advantage of being able to say, "You go there," of at least sometimes remaining behind the platoon which he directed. The private who carried that officer, shot through the shoulder, on his back, while the regiment fell back under the Yankee guns at Pittsburgh Landing, carried him to safety, apparently for the sole purpose of watching him for 2 years more. Writing Judith, meanwhile, that they were both alive, and that was all. And Judith, she lived alone now. Perhaps she had lived alone ever since that Christmas Day last year, and then year before last, and then 3 years, and then 4 years ago. Since though Sutphen was gone now with his and Sartorius's regiment, and the negroes, the wild stock with which he had created Sutphen's 100, had followed the first Yankee troops to pass through Jefferson, she lived in anything but solitude, what with Ellen in bed in the shuttered room, requiring the unremitting attention of a child while she waited with that amazed and passive uncomprehension to die. And she, Judith, and Clytie making and keeping a kitchen garden of sorts to keep them alive, and Wash Jones living in the abandoned and rotting fishing camp in the river bottom which Sutphen had built after the first woman, Ellen, entered his house and the last deer and bear hunter went out of it, where he now permitted Wash and his daughter and infant granddaughter to live, performing the heavy garden work and supplying Ellen and Judith and then Judith with fish and game now and then, even entering the house now, who, until Sutphen went away, had never approached nearer than the scuppernong arbor behind the kitchen, where on Sunday afternoons he and Sutpen would drink from the demijohn and the bucket of spring water which Wash fetched from almost a mile away. Sutpen in the barrel stave hammock, talking, and Wash squatting against a post, chortling and guffawing. Not solitude, and certainly not idleness. The same impenetrable and serene face, only a little older now, a little thinner now, which had appeared in town in the carriage beside her father's within a week after it was learned that her fiancé and her brother had quitted the house in the night and vanished, none knew why or where, and none asked. Just as now none asked when she came to town now, in the made-over dress which all southern women now wore. In the carriage still, but drawn now by a mule, a plough mule, soon the plough mule, and no coachman to drive it either, to put the mule in the harness and take it out, to join the other women where, there were wounded in Jefferson then, in the improvised hospital where, the nurtured virgin, the supremely and traditionally idle, they cleaned and dressed the self-fouled bodies of strange injured and dead, and made lint of the window curtains and sheets and linen of the houses in which they had been born. None to ask her about brother and sweetheart while they talked among themselves of sons and brothers and husbands, with tears and grief perhaps, but at least with certainty, knowledge. She waitin' too, like Henry and Bond, not knowin' for what, but unlike Henry and Bond, she not even knowin' for why. Then Ellen died, the butterfly of a forgotten summer, 2 years defunctive now. The substanceless shell, the shade impervious to any alteration or dissolution because of its very weightlessness. No body to be buried, just the shape, the recollection, translated on some peaceful afternoon without bell or catafalque into that cedar grove. To lie in powder-light paradox beneath the 1,000 pounds of marble monument which Sutphen, Colonel Sutphen now, since Sartorius had been deposed at the annual election of regimental officers the year before, brought in the regimental forage wagon from Charleston, South Carolina, and set above the faint grassy depression which Judith told him was Ellen's grave. And then her grandfather died, starved to death, nailed up in his own attic, and Judith doubtless inviting Miss Rosa to come out to Sutphen's Hundred to live, and Miss Rosa declining. Waitin' too, apparently, upon this letter, this first direct word from Bond in 4 years, and which, a week after she buried him too beside her mother's tombstone, she brought to town herself, in the surrey drawn by the mule which both she and Clytie had learned to catch and harness, and gave to your grandmother, bringin' the letter voluntarily to your grandmother, who, Judith, never called on anyone now, had no friends now, doubtless knowing no more why she chose your grandmother to give the letter to than your grandmother knew. Not thin now, but gaunt, the Sutphen skull showing indeed now through the worn, the cold-field flesh. The face, which had long since forgotten how to be young, and yet absolutely impenetrable, absolutely serene. No mourning, not even grief. And your grandmother saying, me? You want me to keep it? Yes, Judith said, or destroy it, as you like. Read it if you like, or don't read it if you like. Because you make so little impression, you see. You get born, and you try this, and you don't know why, only you keep on trying it, and you are born at the same time with a lot of other people, all mixed up with them, like trying to, having to, move your arms and legs with strings, only the same strings are hitched to all the other arms and legs. And the others are all trying, and they don't know why either, except that the strings are all in one another's way, like 5 or 6 people all trying to make a rug on the same loom. Only each one wants to weave his own pattern into the rug. And it can't matter, you know that. Or the ones that set up the loom would have arranged things a little better. And yet it must matter, because you keep on trying, or having to keep on trying. And then all of a sudden it's all over, and all you have left is a block of stone with scratches on it, provided there was someone to remember to have the marble scratched and set up, or had time to. And it rains on it, and the sun shines on it, and after a while they don't even remember the name and what the scratches were trying to tell, and it doesn't matter. So maybe if you could go to someone, the stranger the better, and give them something, a scrap of paper, something, anything, it not meant to mean anything in itself, and them not even to read it or keep it, not even bother to throw it away or destroy it. At least it would be something, just because it would have happened. Be remembered, even if only from passing from one hand to another, one mind to another. And it would be at least a scratch, something, something that might make a mark on something that was once, for the reason that it can die some day, while the block of stone can't be is, because it can never become was, because it can't ever die or perish. And your grandmother watching her, the impenetrable, the calm, the absolutely serene face, and crying, "No, no, not that. Think of your—" And the face watching her, comprehending, still serene, not even bitter. "Oh, I? No, not that. Because somebody will have to take care of Clytie, and father too soon, who will want something to eat after he comes home, because it won't last much longer since they have begun to shoot one another now. No, not that. Women don't do that for love. I don't even believe that men do, and not now, anyway. Because there wouldn't be any room now for them to go to, wherever it is, if it is. It would be full already, glutted, like a theater, an opera house, if what you expect to find is forgetting, diversion, entertainment. Like a bed already too full if what you want to find is a chance to lie still and sleep and sleep and sleep." Mr. Compson moved. Half rising, Quentin took the letter from him and beneath the dim, bug-fouled globe opened it. Carefully, as though the sheet, the desiccated square, were not the paper but the intact ash of its former shape and substance. And meanwhile, Mr. Compson's voice speaking on while Quentin heard it without listening. "Now you can see why I said that he loved her. Because there were other letters, many of them, gallant, flowery, indolent, frequent, and insincere, sent by hand over that 40 miles between Oxford and Jefferson after that first Christmas. The metropolitan gallants, idle and delicately flattering, and doubtless to him meaningless, gesture to the bucolic maiden. And that bucolic maiden, with that profound and absolutely inexplicable, tranquil, patient clairvoyance of women, against which that metropolitan gallant's foppish posturing was just the jackanape antics of a small boy. Receiving the letters without understanding them, not even keeping them, for all their elegant and gallant and tediously contrived turns of form and metaphor, until the next one arrived. But keeping this one, which must have reached her out of a clear sky after an interval of 4 years, considering this one worthy to give to a stranger to keep or not to keep, even to read or not to read as the stranger saw fit, to make that scratch, that undying mark on the blank face of the oblivion to which we are all doomed, of which she spoke." Quentin, hearing, without having to listen, as he read the faint spidery script, not like something impressed upon the paper by a once-living hand, but like a shadow cast upon it which had resolved on the paper the instant before he looked at it, and which might fade, vanish, at any instant, while he still did. The dead tongue speaking after the 4 years, and then after almost 50 more. Gentle, sardonic, whimsical, and incurably pessimistic, without date or salutation or signature. "You will notice how I insult neither of us by claiming this to be a voice from the defeated, even, let alone from the dead. In fact, if I were a philosopher, I should deduce and derive a curious and apt commentary on the times and augur of the future from this letter which you now hold in your hands, a sheet of notepaper with, as you can see, the best of French watermarks dated 70 years ago, salvaged, stolen, if you will, from the gutted mansion of a ruined aristocrat, and written upon in the best of stove polish, manufactured not 12 months ago in a New England factory. Yes, stove polish. We captured it. A story in itself. Imagine us, an assortment of homogeneous scarecrows, I won't say hungry, because to a woman, lady or female either, below Masons and Dixons in this year of grace 1865, that word would be sheer redundancy, like saying we were breathing. And I won't say ragged or even shoeless, since we have been both long enough to have grown accustomed to it. Only, thank God, and this restores my faith not in human nature, perhaps, but at least in man, that he really does not become inured to hardship and privation. It is only the mind, the gross, omnivorous, carrion-heavy soul which becomes inured. The body itself, thank God, never reconciled from the old soft feel of soap and clean linen, and something between the sole of the foot and the earth to distinguish it from the foot of a beast. So say we merely needed ammunition. And imagine us, the scarecrows, with one of those concocted plans of scarecrow desperation which not only must but do work, for the reason that there is absolutely no room for alternative before man or heaven, no niche on earth or under it for failure, to find space either to pause or breathe or be graved and sepulchred. And we, the scarecrows, bringing it off with a great deal of elan, not to say noise. Imagine, I say, the prey and prize, the 10 plump, defenseless sutler's wagons, the scarecrows tumbling out box after beautiful box after beautiful box, stenciled each with that U and that S, which for 4 years now has been to us the symbol of the spoils which belong to the vanquished, of the loaves and the fishes, as was once the incandescent brow, the shining nimbus of the thorny crown. And the scarecrows clawing at the boxes with stones and bayonets and even with bare hands, and opening them at last and finding, what? Stove polish. Gallons and gallons and gallons of the best stove polish. Not a box of it a year old yet, and doubtless still trying to overtake General Sherman with some belated amended field order requiring him to polish the stove before firing the house. How we laughed. Yes, we laughed, because I have learned this at least during these 4 years, that it really requires an empty stomach to laugh with, that only when you are hungry or frightened do you extract some ultimate essence out of laughing, just as the empty stomach extracts the ultimate essence out of alcohol. But at least we have stove polish. We have plenty of it. We have too much, because it does not take much to say what I have to say, as you can see. And so the conclusion and augury which I draw, even though no philosopher, is this. We have waited long enough. You will notice how I do not insult you either by saying I have waited long enough. And therefore, since I do not insult you by saying that only I have waited, I do not add, expect me, because I cannot say when to expect me, because what was is one thing. And now it is not, because it is dead. It died in 1861, and therefore what is? There, they have started firing again, which, to mention it, is redundancy too, like the breathing or the need of ammunition, because sometimes I think it has never stopped. It hasn't stopped, of course, I don't mean that. I mean there has never been any more of it. That there was that one fusillade 4 years ago which sounded once and then was arrested, mesmerized, raised muzzle by raised muzzle, in the frozen attitude of its own aghast amazement, and never repeated. And it now only the loud aghast echo jarred by the dropped musket of a weary sentry or by the fall of the spent body itself, out of the air which lies over the land where that fusillade first sounded, and where it must remain yet, because no other space under heaven will receive it. So that means it is dawn again, and that I must stop. Stop what, you will say? Why, thinking, remembering. Remark that I do not say, hoping. To become once more for a period without boundaries or location in time, mindless and irrational companion and inmate of a body which, even after 4 years, with a sort of dismal and incorruptible fidelity which is incredibly admirable to me, is still immersed and obliviously bemused in recollections of old peace and contentment, the very names of whose scents and sounds I do not know that I remember, which ignores even the presence and threat of a torn arm or leg as though through some secretly incurred and infallible promise and conviction of immortality. But to finish, I cannot say when to expect me, because what is something else again, because it was not even alive then. And since because within this sheet of paper you now hold the best of the old South, which is dead, and the words you read were written upon it with the best, each box said the very best, of the new North which has conquered and which therefore, whether it likes it or not, will have to survive, I now believe that you and I are, strangely enough, included among those who are doomed to live. And that's all, Mr. Compson said. She received it, and she and Clatty made the wedding gown and the veil from scraps, perhaps scraps intended for, which should have gone for, lint and did not. She didn't know when he would come because he didn't know himself. And maybe he told Henry, showed Henry the letter before he sent it, and maybe he did not. Maybe still just the watching and the waiting, the one saying to Henry, I have waited long enough, and Henry saying to the other, Do you renounce, then? Do you renounce? And the other saying, I do not renounce. For 4 years now I have given Chance the opportunity to renounce for me, but it seems that I am doomed to live, that she and I both are doomed to live. The defiance and the ultimatum delivered beside a bivouac fire, the ultimatum discharged before the gate to which the two of them must have ridden side by side almost. The one calm and undeviating, perhaps unresisting even, the fatalist to the last, the other remorseless with implacable and unalterable grief and despair. It seemed to Quentin that he could actually see them, facing one another at the gate. Inside the gate, what was once a park, now spread, unkempt, in shaggy desolation, with an air dreamy, remote, and aghast, like the unshaven face of a man just waking from ether, up to a huge house where a young girl waited in a wedding dress made from stolen scraps, the house partaking too of that air of scaling desolation, not having suffered from invasion but a shell marooned and forgotten in a backwater of catastrophe. A skeleton giving of itself in slow driblets of furniture and carpet, linen and silver, to help to die torn and anguished men who knew even while dying that for months now the sacrifice and the anguish were in vain. They faced one another on the two gaunt horses, two men, young, not yet in the world, not yet breathed over long enough to be old, but with old eyes, with unkempt hair and faces gaunt and weathered as if cast by some Spartan and even niggard hand from bronze, in worn and patched gray, weathered now to the color of dead leaves, the one with the tarnished braid of an officer, the other plain of cuff, the pistol lying yet across the saddle bow unaimed, the two faces calm, the voices not even raised. Don't you pass the shadow of this post, this branch, Charles. And I am going to pass it, Henry. And then Wash Jones, sitting that saddleless mule before Miss Rose's gate, shouting her name into the sunny and peaceful quiet of the street, saying, Are you Rosa Coldfield? Then you better come on out, yon. Henry has done shot that dern French fellow. Killed him dead as a beef.